This is Radio EcoShock.
This is Alex Smith. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. We're talking about post-normal science. We're talking about transition science and wicked problems. Be patient. If you know nothing about any of this, you will by the end. I'll start with a clip by Dr. Jerome Ravitz of Oxford on how the idea of a wicked problem began in the 1970s.
As you may have noticed, the idea of wicked problems, this was first announced in 1973. It's a long time ago, even before post-normal science. This came from a couple of people who had been involved in the American society, the attempts to solve the great problems of especially American cities and poverty. And what had been going on in the 60s is that Congress would pass a law saying we are going to spend money solving the housing problem or solving the youth problem or whatever. And lots of money would be spent. And at the end of a few years, it seemed nothing had happened and people got very fed up. And eventually, these two people who'd been involved in planning came to see that a city is not the same thing as a petri dish in a lab, that a city is an organism, messy, contradictory, with a life of its own. And so then that's how they got this idea of wicked problems. You can go right back to the very naive, idealistic attempt to solve social problems as if they were a textbook exercise. Clearly, some of these problems get solved in a way, like, for instance, in America, the problem of race has been to some extent solved. They now have an African-American president, but other problems have not been solved. And we now learn that it takes some deep changes to make real solutions to these problems.
Now we'll hear Jerome Ravitz's 7-minute webcast presentation, which I recorded February 24th, 2011.
Hello. We're talking about wicked problems and post-normal science and transition science. So those are three concepts that we will try to explore. And I begin with what we call normal science. And this term is taken from the philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn, who described normal science as puzzle solving. And that style of doing science, of slicing it down, abstracting from all the complexities of nature, and then solving a problem either for knowledge or for power, has brought us great knowledge and great power. And it's thanks largely to that that we live in a civilization where we have such comfort and convenience and safety. And we in the rich countries take for granted that we switch the light and the electricity comes on, we jump into our car, drive down to the shops, and everything works. Now, that is the background, and I think anyone who makes criticisms of this system has to appreciate that by and large, up to now, the system has worked fantastically well based on this normal science. But now we have the great problems of the day, which appear largely as environmental, but also as health problems, where we have complexity, uncertainty, and value conflicts, so that simply setting up a research puzzle to be solved doesn't answer the immediate question of what we should do. Out there in the environment, we have, for instance, the gender-bending chemicals that come from all of the sophisticated pharmaceutical products that are washed into the environment. We have urgent problems like the loss of bumblebees, for which the explanation is still not complete. We even have some evidence of harm from genetically manipulated crops. This is highly contested, but not to be thrown away. And so in every case, we have complex situations, we have highly uncertain facts, and we then have conflicts of value in what to do about it. And simply to say, oh, well, let's do more research is necessary, but not sufficient, because even to set the research problem takes imagination and also managing the value conflict in the question of who is going to set the priorities, who's going to pay for the results, who is going to control what is discovered. When I look at the sort of work that goes on and consider how the style of isolated, abstracted, reductionist science compares to the great pressing problems of our time, I call it paleo-normal. That is the idea of rather old-fashioned, out-of-date, clever in its own way, necessary in many respects, but still not answering the needs of the time. And some of you will know, here is the mantra from post-normal science. We have facts uncertain, values in dispute, stakes high, and decisions urgent. When we have a problem, let's say like the bumblebees as an example, we cannot rely totally on the narrowly trained expertise. Because, first of all, the expert is trained to solve puzzles in a normal science way. The expert is not trained to handle great uncertainties and value conflicts. And then also, the expert may himself or herself not be aware of it, but somebody is paying for that expert, and that person or institution who's paying will frame the sorts of exercises that are looked at and also those that are not. This is not to say that anyone is deliberately corrupt or biased, but simply any study will have a focus and will then exclude things from that focus. And that is why the puzzle-solving expertise is not adequate. So when I call for a post-normal science, I say it embraces uncertainties and values. It's really a question of being aware. Aware of the uncertainties, aware of the values, aware of the tentative nature of any results that are obtained, and then more important, aware of the contribution that people can make who are not trained. Now, this is what I call the extended peer community, all those willing to engage on dialogue, on defining the problems and attempting their solutions. We have had examples of this. A great example is Lyme disease, which we now know to be carried by a certain tick that infests deer and then passes it to humans. But for a very long time, it looked like a very bad case of flu, which didn't clear. And it was only some citizens, actually some mothers whose children got very sick, who insisted that there's something more going on here and eventually forced the authorities to take it seriously. And in this town of Lyme, Connecticut, yes, they discovered it's a real disease. Now, question of how the new community is to be engaged. And that is, for me, one of the very important questions for science of our time. Now, we know that they will appear when there's an urgent issue that affects them, because these are people who are normally just going about their business until something hits them. So it's usually bad news that mobilizes people. In addition to Lyme disease, there's this famous case of Woburn, Massachusetts, where people felt that their water was being polluted. Again, they got the brush off and finally mobilized and forced the authorities to see, yes, there's something going on. Valerie will be talking about that sort of thing at greater length. I should say there's another example from down under. A very distinguished community scientist, Phil Tattersall in Tasmania, has organized a citizens' audit of proposals, which does the same sort of thing. But hitherto, people who have been wanting to engage in this sort of science have been hampered. They lack organization, they lack certified expertise, and they even have lacked a complete effective theory of their work. Up to now, almost all science is done inside institutions that command resources and prestige, and to try to do scientific work outside those institutions is very difficult indeed. And so the people, this extended peer community, has had all of the obstacles in its way, not necessarily deliberate, but simply because they are not inside the system. And so the question will be, how can we make these people who are quite essential to the good use of science in confronting our environmental problems, indeed the problems of sustainability, how to make them effective? That is where Valerie Brown has some ideas which will organize the whole effort.
Next up is Valerie A. Brown, Emeritus Professor of Environmental Health at the University of Western Sydney. Her latest book is Tackling Wicked Problems Through the Transdisciplinary Imagination. Valerie's talk is dense. It's loaded with five principal types of knowledge that we need to work through for our ecological and energy challenges. But then she gives an example from the Port Pirie lead mine, Australia's largest. Children there suffered gross lead poisoning, with authorities saying nothing until the community found resolution. Listen for that. I promise you, there are tools here that you can use to transition in your own community.
Greetings, and Jerome, thank you very much for giving us an understanding of your post-normal science, which has influenced so many over the years. I'm building on Jerome's work with a proposition that there are limits to traditional science's capacity to resolve the wicked problems arising from socio-environmental change. That's actually a big proposition, because it would change, if we accept that, then we will change everything that we do. Building on this proposition, we look at the word wicked problems, and wicked problems are complex problems that defy resolution by any of the problem-solving methods that we need today. So they are things like global warming, industrial pollution, food security, urban violence, the examples Jerome has given to us. These are complex problems, but they're complex problems that are embedded in society. And since you can't cure society, you clearly have to take some other approach to it. So having looked at what a wicked problem is and recognizing we can't cure society, we therefore have to accept that we're looking at a new understanding of the world. Wicked problems have many causes. They involve multiple interests. They evade any single definition, because all those causes and all those interests would have a separate definition. And perhaps one of the most important of all, they require social change. And there can be no final solution, because if you move to social change, you move to a new situation and you can't be sure what would happen. So you're back to the uncertainty that Jerome talked about. And one of the things one has to be prepared for is the solutions will have unknown consequences. So we need a new way of thinking about science before we can resolve a wicked problem. Now, we've been discussing ways of doing science. There's paleo-normal science and post-normal science, which, again, Jerome has explained. I'm going to propose, and it's a brave proposal, that we need a new science, and we might as well call it transition science. Now I'm going to look not just inside at what we're thinking, but outside at the real world and what happens when we make decisions on wicked problems in the real world. Resolving a wicked problem calls for a transition science based on collective decisions. Since it's multi-causal, multi-interest, therefore a collective decision will involve multiple interests. And in working with over 300 communities right across Asia Pacific and in Europe, we've consistently found that the multiple interests that make an effective and lasting decision are these five. Key individuals in the matter, affected community, specialized advice, the influential organizations that have power over the situation, and holistic thinking. The center three are quite common. You're always hearing calls for community experts and supporting organizations or government. I think our work has added the two others, which are the key individuals and the holistic thinking. So I'd like to build on that. And it suggests that if you have multiple interests, each of those interests has its own knowledge construction, and this is certainly what we found in the field. If you take individual knowledge based on personal lived experience, if you're looking at the community, you have local knowledge, which is based on shared community events. If you're calling in an expert, they will come from the particular box that they're trained in. They can contribute enormously from, but they will be constrained within that box. Strategic knowledge is the organizational agenda. Organizations bring our resources, but they often also bring their own objectives. Holistic knowledge gives focus and vision. So we have not only multiple interests, but in the field we've discovered that those knowledges are built perhaps more firmly into their separate compartments than one might imagine. The knowledges reject each other. I'm sure everybody has heard these words, these abusive words, used to describe the different knowledges. And one of the troubles, I think, in working to bring them together is that there's a grain of truth in every single one. So individual knowledge can be biased, local knowledge can be merely an anecdote, specialized knowledge can think in jargon, strategic knowledge is by definition often self-serving, and holistic knowledge is often dismissed as airy-fairy. And if one's a researcher or wants to go deeper, what we find is that the authors that expand those knowledges and help us understand them are also in boxes. So looking at transition science, I'm going to suggest that it's a nested set. The relationships between those knowledges are many and varied, but for a constructive study of research inquiry, decision-making, you're going to need them all. And here, there's a sort of mandala, which is much neater than real life, of course. But I'm suggesting that all knowledge is based in the individual. Local knowledge is built on a group of individuals. Specialized knowledge studies the behavior of those individuals. Organizational knowledge looks at the practical application of those findings. And holistic knowledge is the gestalt, the core that makes possible for all the others to talk together and understand them. In case that seems too abstract and separate, let me give you an example of one of our studies. Port Pirie in Australia is a small town with the biggest lake smelter in the world. So this is our small town, and the children in the small town, over 50% of the children were diagnosed with a lead level over the WHO limit, some of them seriously life-threatening over the lead limit. And what happened in that community when we first went into it? It was known that the children were lead affected. The community was so long resigned to living with lead risks that they absorbed the information quite inertly. The specialist involved, there was a health centre, the health centre was involved in the lead testing, but of course they were objective, weren't they? And they didn't get involved in politics, so they stayed aloof. The organisation was the mine, obviously, like all big mining enterprises, practically owned the council. All council members except one were mine employees. And the holistic focus of everybody in that town was fear for their future livelihood. If the mine had to close down, which indeed they felt it was threatened if they had to go to great expense to limit the lead. So the fear for future livelihood was the dominant holistic focus. After organising people to talk to each other in open dialogue, as Jerome has also recommended, and giving opportunities to cross those barriers to reject those preconceived ideas, it started with a parent and a grandparent of a lead-affected child who would not sit quiet, who started to make a very active advocacy for something to be done. They sparked the community, which then, in outrage and political action, actually jolted the specialists into thinking, yes, they were part of this enterprise, and their technical skills and their advocacy, which is not, of course, normal science, but is post-normal science. The organisation realised that they had an obligation to public and private good, both on their commercial bottom line and their own self-respect. And the focus, the holistic focus, changed from jobs to children's well-being. And there is now, won't go on into the actions that were taken, but certainly the mine discovered it could find some lead trapping equipment that was not going to bankrupt it. And as you see, the specialists started to advocate, the community started political action, and we had tremendous change. So there's a practical example of what I've been talking about, and there would be many examples, and I suspect many examples in your own practice, of where those five understandings or ways of thinking or knowledge constructions, if they're brought together, they can do almost anything. But at the moment, they're in our culture, our Western culture, they tend to be seriously apart. So I'd like to ask everybody who's listening, where does transition science fit into your own decision-making?
If you want to work more through this, you can re-listen to the program, download it from our website at ecoshock.org. I listen to every program at least twice. You can also order Valerie Brown's book, Tackling Wicked Problems, through earthscan.co.uk, and check out my show blog for more links. Both Ravitz and Brown introduced My Final Hope. We'll start with Valerie Brown.
It takes a little while for us all to realize that we have global communication now. We have many, many local projects which are joining together like a pastiche or a collage that all over the world. There's transition towns, there's healthy cities, there's sustainable communities. Now, they're all global projects crossing many countries, many languages, spontaneously centered in the local understanding of what it would take to change. So we actually do have a pattern right now. The connections are new and sometimes quite tenuous, but if you watch it, I think it is a growing understanding and a growing capacity to change the globe.
And now, for an over-the-top, outright hope that humans can develop a better global mind through technology. Don't laugh. I dismissed this line for years, until the Twitter protests in Iran, until the combined power of Twitter, Facebook, and Al Jazeera over the internet shook North African dictatorships to the core. Under the title Paradigm Tales, an EcoShock friend from Colorado posted an inspiring version of a speech by Professor of Law Eben Moghlen. So Ethan Moghlen is a professor of law and legal history at Columbia University, and he's the founder of the Software Freedom Law Center. In a very recent speech by Professor Moghlen, right after the fall of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, he was speaking at FOSDEM, the Free and Open Source Software Developers European Meeting, in Brussels, Belgium, February 5th, 2011. I'm going to cram in as much as I can in our remaining time, find all the links and a downloadable video and the artistic digest from Paradigm Tales, all at ecoshock.info. Buckle up.
Wikipedia and WikiLeaks are two sides of the same coin. They are the two sides of the same coin, the third side of which is FOSDEM. It is the power of ordinary people to organize to change the world, without having to create hierarchy and without having to recapitulate the structures of power that are being challenged by the desire to make freedom. WikiLeaks was being treated everywhere around the world in a semi-criminal fashion at Christmas time. And then events in Tunisia made it a little more complicated, as it became clear that what was being reported on around the world as though it were primarily a conspiracy to injure the dignity of the U.S. State Department or to embarrass the United States military was actually really an attempt to allow people to learn about their world, to learn about how power really operates, and therefore to do something about it. And what happened in Tunisia was, I thought, an eloquent rebuttal to the idea that the WikiLeaks end of free culture and free software was primarily engaged in destruction, nihilism, or, I shrink from even employing the word in this context, terrorism. It was instead freedom, which is messy, complicated, potentially damaging in the short term, but salvational in the long term. The medicine for the human soul. We must have the ability to make our various arts collaboratively out of what we have already done by adding imagination untaxed to what already is. This is a promise for an acceleration of education throughout the globe. Billions of minds hungering for knowledge and for beauty, to whom everything can now be given. In a world where everything is a bitstream, where the marginal cost of culture is zero, where once one person has something, everything can be given to everybody, at the same cost that it was given to its first possessor, it is immoral to exclude people from knowledge and from beauty. That is the great moral problem that the 20th century has bequeathed to the 21st. We can eradicate ignorance at the expense of a few. We have to do it. We cannot permit the voluntary starvation of most of the minds on the planet. We have a duty. We have a joy. We are bringing to our colleagues, the human race, everything we know and everything we love. There is no higher pleasure than delivering what we love to those with whom we wish to share it. There is also no deeper moral obligation. Free hardware and free software are two-thirds of the platform for free culture. But without bandwidth, boxes sit dumb. We must recapture for everyone the common property of the electromagnetic spectrum. Every legal system at its bottom agrees that the spectrum is common, that it belongs to all. And every legal system denies as practical reality what it proposes as principle. Every system continues to maintain that government must control how spectrum is used, sometimes quite explicitly for the purpose of remaining itself in power, sometimes in a claim of some civilizing mission on the belief that government and only government can really artfully determine who ought to speak to the masses in the interest of the expansion of knowledge. And sometimes, as in my society, out of sheer venality, we, the politicians, have taken bribes from you, the media owners, and we will faithfully reflect the interests of our masters who have put us in. But whatever the reason may be, whether venality or lust for power or a misguided belief in the superiority of government wisdom about who should speak to many, spectrum allocation is an evil whose time has come. This is far more complicated than the problems that we have solved in freeing software, more complicated than the problem that we face in keeping hardware free, far more complicated than the problem of inducing 12-year-olds to share music and help free culture. But it is not beyond our power on the basis of what we already have. We need dream no utopian dreams to achieve bandwidth for all on equal terms. We possess already working code and proof of concept. It is called Wi-Fi. It is the attempt to use a small, not particularly desirable piece of spectrum to model the possibility of self-organized, non-hierarchical, decentralized, equal measure access to electromagnetic spectrum. And we are showing what the alternative actually is. Those of us here who work on this issue are able to show to populations all around the globe the telephone bill-less future. The place where nobody pays to talk to anybody else by the sip, by the minute, by the tick, by the impulse anymore. We can build that thick mesh that embraces all of us and add at communal expense the long-haul communications portions which tie that mesh together, and we can offer people equality of communication. Mr. Murdoch will be disappointed. Deutsche Telekom will be heartbroken. Tough.
That was Professor Eben Moglen addressing the Free Software Forum in Brussels, Belgium, February 5th, 2011. Find links to the full presentation at ecoshock.info. We are out of time, but not out of dreams. I'm Alex Smith. Let's meet next week on Radio EcoShock and find us on Twitter @EcoShock.